It's showtime.
Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. We are off and running. I am already told that we are sending very nicely both at headonradionetwork.com, whiterosesociety.org. Tune in, and of course, headon.live. This is the horn. Headonradionetwork.com is where we live. That's where you go if you'd like to jump into the madcap multimedia, real-time, zany, wacky multimedia. I mentioned that extravaganza that is the program, for the hours during which this program is live, during 3 to 6 p.m. Pacific, 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern, okay? Yeah. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. I'm a little tongue-tied, I suppose, but we are off and running for this final broadcast of the month of August 2017. There will never be another one like it. Each individual program at the Horn is, in fact, unique. Except the ones that are reruns. I mean, you get that. The last day of August 2017 falls on a thorn in the side Thursday. And it's a good thing that it does, because we got thorns. You know, love is a rose, but you better not pick it. It only grows when it's on the vine. Handful of thorns, and you know you missed it. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's where we are. If, of course, you'd like to go and pick yourself out a screen name and a password and enter the chat room, you will, of course, be met by Anatole and Earther and Hoghead and Jug of Punch and Laborman and VT Blom and, of course, capably moderated by Midweek Utility Pinch Hit chat room moderator and all-around great guy, Steve from Georgistan. Alrighty. And of course, this will be one of two fundraising-free programs to end the month of August, with the single exception of thanks going out. Thanks go out to our buddy Patrick in Germany. Thank you very kindly for helping out. And thanks go out to Mark. Thank you, Mark. Thank you for helping out as well. And tomorrow will begin a brand new month. So, as I noted, it is Thorn in the Side Thursday. We reserve those for those moments that just, ow, you know, right. Definitely not feathers in our caps. Thorns in our side. It's a Catch-22 reference that was brought to us many years ago, or suggested or recommended by our buddy Horst in Taiwan. Let's see. I think this is going to be an appropriate beginning to the program. Just got a note a little bit ago from Steve on the Gulf Coast, whom we've heard from in in the past as Steve in China. Subject line, America's Sacrifice Zone. Not to worry, drinking water's being supplied to the thirsty. Well, if they can buy it. And emergency housing? Well, they won't be gouged for emergency housing if they can afford it. And the billions of dollars in disaster relief that should be flowing into Texas? Not to fear. The feds right now are working on it. The immediate future? Irma is steaming toward the vicinity of the Gulf, soon to be churning steadily into and through the Caribbean Basin. God bless the Cajun Navy. Hats off to all the real and regular and extraordinary folk who know and do what needs to be done forever and for all. Katrina. Oh, Katrina, my love. Because we are expected, impelled to take lessons from history to prepare for the worst. And today? Well, Vice President Pence lowered himself long enough to toss a few sticks of wood around the yard, so long as the TV cameras were focused and running. And the asshat in chief, what of him? Oh, who really fucking cares? White ball cap, same brown stinking shit. Who has the food or the water or the shelter when there are so many energy wars to wage or North Korean crackpots to coddle? Regards, Steve, somewhere on the Gulf Coast. Update coming in from Carol Baker. Just in from my friend Rob, lines up to a mile long at the few gas stations in San Antonio that still have gasoline. People are running out of gas while in line or waiting for hours only to have the tanks go empty before they get to the pumps. Gasoline went up another 21 cents a gallon here today. We're up to $2.60, but we have gasoline. And I fear there are going to be more such similar stories. It's almost guaranteed. Because, well, this is a country that for so long has had a love affair with free market fantasies and notions that, when Ronald Reagan said, what was it, government's not the solution, government is the problem. When he said that, he was giving voice to a nascent movement that really, really metastasized and picked up both energy and speed at that moment, and it has continued to poison our body politic ever since. Had any of the people who founded this nation heard him say such a thing, they would have slapped him so hard the grease would have flown out of his hair. Because it does run contrary. I know, history. No, they were not perfect people, yet they badly flawed human beings. But in the realm of an idea about a government that's based on the common weal, the common good, the pursuit of happiness on a community basis, you know, something that can kind of stand the test of time philosophically. The idea of one's government being one's enemy, which is what Reagan put in place, Reagan and allies, etc., it really has taken us to a bad juncture at this point. But we have thorns in the side. For instance, I ran across a Washington Post article. I'm sure at some point in time some member of the ideological purity brigade will castigate me for even letting my eyeballs rest upon pixels representing letters published into words by the Washington Post, but nonetheless, the headline reads, Harvey is a 1,000-year flood event unprecedented in scale.
And I read this and I thought, you know, maybe we'd better stop talking about these massive natural disasters as being one-offs. Because they're not. Not by a long shot. And if you don't, if you take weather events, you know, I think we can leave out volcanoes and earthquakes, except for the earthquakes that are caused by, you know, fracking. But if you take weather events, as scientists have, and you extrapolate climate change into them, you're going to wind up with something that looks an awful lot like what has been happening over the last few years. In one's best stentorian newscaster voice, as Harvey's rains unfolded, the intensity and scope of the disaster were so enormous that weather forecasters, first responders, the victims, everyone really couldn't believe their eyes. Now the data are bearing out what everyone suspected. This flood event is on an entirely different scale than what we've seen before in the United States. You know, we could probably concede some of that. I mean, the area where 20 inches of rain fell was bigger than some entire states, in particular, you know, West Virginia, for instance. But anytime there's flooding that affects entire communities, you're going to see strains put, because of where our country now is, you're going to see strains put upon the ability of the country, regardless of how rich this country is, you're going to see strains put upon our country's ability to respond to them. And the more that they happen, one on top of another, on top of another, on top of another, the more likely it is that we will eventually get, we will eventually see systems strained to the breaking point. For instance, as I referenced last night, it is entirely possible, if not likely or certain, that this particular disaster will be the one that finally breaks the federal flood insurance program. And that's even with the understanding that only something on the order of 20% of people who have endured this flooding in this latest disaster actually had the coverage. Ponder that for a moment. So the Washington Post article says that a new analysis from the University of Wisconsin Space Science and Engineering Center has determined that Harvey is a 1-in-1,000-year flood event that has overwhelmed an enormous section of southeast Texas, equivalent in size to New Jersey. Again with the 1-in-1,000 years. What's going to happen when what has just been described by an expert as a 1-in-1,000-year event, what's going to happen when that 1-in-1,000-year event happens in another 5 or 10 or 15, 20, 25, even 50 years, even 100 years? That sort of wrecks the idea of a 1-in-1,000-year event. And on top of that, how do we deal with the fact that science, climate science, even in its most conservative estimates, have said that, oh yeah, this is going to happen a lot more? And of course, it is happening a lot more. I mean, my God, the area where 20 inches of rain fell was a 29,000-square-mile area. And as the Post article notes, that's bigger than 10 states. It's more than twice the size of West Virginia. Or I'm sorry, of Maryland. Okay? This is mind-boggling to try to consider, and it does not help to have people say, well, you know, and I mean, it's happened. It's a 1-in-1,000-year event. I mean, my God, at least we can take solace in the fact that it's not going to happen again. It's going to happen again. I mean, I don't want to get all tear at my hair, shrieky freaky, but it's going to happen again. And there are elements within the going to happen again that are even more terrifying than what has already happened. The expert to whom the Washington Post spoke, namely Shane Hubbard, the researcher at the Wisconsin Center, University of Wisconsin Space Science and Engineering Center, said that we have to call it a 1-in-1,000-year flood because people have to have some way of planning for the future. Well, from where I stand, it is not helpful to tell people that it's a 1-in-1,000-year event and let them plan accordingly, saying, well, you know, I mean, this is as bad as it can ever get. Because it clearly isn't. By way of an excuse or explanation, maybe, Hubbard said, decision makers have to be able to pick a number and say, this is the number we need to be prepared for. If we debate and belabor the accuracy of these estimates, the community will not have a value to plan for. How about we start with the notion that whatever the plan, whatever planning there was, and this is part of the problem, there was very goddamn little planning along the Texas Gulf Coast because freedom. Because job-killing regulations. More on that in a minute. So maybe some actual planning would be a good idea. If you can get people in Texas to actually stop voting for the fetuses and start voting for the living human beings. And frankly, you have to kind of come to grips with the fact that that's going to be a really damn difficult thing to do. Exactly, Carol Baker. Yeah, it's a 1,000-year event. Till next year. I mean, it was 20 years ago, and I remember it very specifically because it was March, and we were in the midst of, well, I was just sort of watching. But Agnes was in the midst of having our last baby. Every one of our children was accompanied by some sort of meteorological disaster. Margie arrived in the worst ice storm in 100 years. Ferg arrived in the midst of the deepest snow we'd had in ages. And sort of finishing things off, Doodle showed up, and brought Doodle showed up under a comet hanging in the sky, and brought with her 500-year floods. But the problem is, in a world with a changing climate, 500-year floods aren't 500-year floods anymore. The Washington Post article continues, Hubbard agrees that the climate is changing and precipitation is becoming more intense in some areas. But he said it would be complicated to adapt the flood return frequencies. The challenge is trying to separate when you have these 500-year events happening all the time. What part is a changing climate? What part is changes in urbanization and agriculture and what part is the lack of understanding of what's happened in the past? So you can tell me if I'm wrong, but doesn't that sound a little like hair splitting? Not everybody necessarily agrees with Mr. Hubbard or Dr. Hubbard. David Titley is a professor of meteorology at Penn State. And he tweeted simply, expect Harvey flood record will be broken in 5, 15, 25 years from now. Sooner rather than later. And for the most part, that entire area of the Texas Gulf Coast is represented politically by people who reject climate change. So necessarily, that has made everything about this storm manifestly worse, because there was virtually no preparation at all. Sure, there will be isolated places where they'll say, well, you know, we built our overpasses a little higher. But in terms of an overall organized, coordinated scheme, Compare this, for instance, with South Florida, where even though the Florida state government is so wild-eyedly, is that an adverb? Well, it is now. So wild-eyedly opposed to science itself that they forbid state employees from even uttering the words sea level rise or climate change. Well, city governments in places that know that they're already having to damned well deal with it, like South Miami Beach, they are of an entirely different political mindset. And even so, they're helpless. And frankly, there's the question of how one engineers around something like this. Do you just build giant seawalls 5 miles out to sea? And we think Trump's stupid Mexico wall's going to be expensive. At that point in time, you're delaying the inevitable because eventually, whatever you do manage to keep dry, everywhere that you manage to keep dry under a scheme like that is going to wind up being one great big giant lower ninth ward. And that encompasses the God knows how many millions of people who live in South Florida. And with Irma out there churning, as our buddy Steve on the Gulf Coast mentions, and all they can do is project that, right now it's probably going to be a hurricane, and it's pointed at the Leeward Isles, which is kind of weird in the first place. But of all the ways, short of, that's right, Silent R. Lamar, America, land of the three little pigs. Houses built of straw. If you just think of the general seascape of the Gulf of Mexico, something that comes in down toward the Leeward Isles maximizes the amount of area it has in which to spin and churn and gather up, you know, heat energy and get stronger and stronger and stronger. And what, I guess people are, some percentage of Americans are looking at it and going, let it hit Mexico, please, let it hit Mexico. At least Mexico acknowledges climate change. God, Venezuela donated us $5 million. Venezuela that Dolt 45 was suggesting he might like to invade a couple of weeks back. Note coming in from Steve in New York. Subject line, I'm terrified. As I recall, the predictions of this storm were up to 35 inches. As I think I've seen, I think it's at least 15 inches more than that. Likewise, I've seen cost to rebuild at $160 billion. I think it'll be closer to $300 billion, just to get us back to square one. That doesn't even begin to count the cost of post-flood medical problems, unemployment insurance, and other costs. Is $1 trillion out of the question? I don't really think so. Yeah, but just remember, what America needs is a great big massive tax cut for corporations and the rich. That's what we're being told. And don't overlook the possibility that this disaster may actually be leveraged for purposes of saying that Congress really has to get after this this infrastructure bill. The obvious need of it has been proven by Hurricane Harvey, and so we need to have that fire sale and auction off the entire infrastructure of the United States to corporate interests. Toot sweet, baby. I do have, I got a couple of sort of fantasy remedies. I confess, I think about these things. They provide me some degree of solace. It's kind of like, I don't know, when the Powerball was, you know, way up crazy numbers, and people who never play the lottery suddenly went out and spent the dollar, you know, because suddenly a chance at $700 million, that was worth it. Even though the chances were no more nor less than they are when they're, you know, 20 or 40 or whatever. But you buy the ticket, it gives you the right to fantasize about what you would do with the money. And to a certain extent, in moments like this, it provides you an opportunity to fantasize about how we might make America a little bit better. Current reporting says that the Congress will take up the issue of Harvey relief sometime in the coming month, which begins tomorrow. And I have a suggestion. We let the Texas delegation put together a Christmas list of everything they want. Not just to, as Steve notes, not just to get back to square one, but to actually, finally, begin to prepare for what's coming again and long before any 1,000 years. Probably before 100 years. Probably before 50 years. As Dr. Titley pointed out, odds are the flood record of Harvey will be broken in 5, 15, 25 years. That means there's a decent chance that a whole lot of members of the Horn Family Community Congregation, even if there's no more Horn, that will be around to see that record broken. Shit, we may see it broken this year. Depends on what Irma does. But anyway, let the Texas delegation pull together a Christmas list. And then let a majority of the Congress in both houses say, okay, here are the strings that are attached. We're going to vote you exactly what you want. What? You wanted to pad in some pork in your Harvey relief for a really, really, really big, giant statue of Jesus smack dab in downtown Austin? By God, we're going to put it in there. We're going to give it to you. You want to build a cenotaph to aborted fetuses? We're going to give that to you, too. Here's all you got to do. Every member of your congressional delegation before the vote has to stand up and say, I hereby acknowledge that anthropogenic climate change is real. That's all you got to do. It operates on the same model as their religion does. All you got to do is confess your faith in the Lord Jesus Christ and thou shalt be saved. Easy, huh? Oh, by the way, there's a second condition. Ted Cruz has to go. If you want this, then all that has to happen is Ted Cruz has to resign from the Senate of the United States and promise never to enter politics ever, 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 ever again. If we wanted to be hard asses about it, we could make that demand of every Republican member of the Texas congressional delegation. And say, hey, y'all are free to elect a new crop of nincompoops, but every one of those has to acknowledge climate change. That's all. Just acknowledge science. Science really doesn't care. But if you've got people in the offices who acknowledge climate change, maybe there's a way to keep some of this from happening to you again. Because these are the remorseless motherfuckers who helped make it happen. And this isn't just me speculating. This is fucking reality. And I can prove it. I have it right here in front of me. Because, you see, there was a little secondary disaster overnight continuing into today in a little community called Crosby, Texas. At a chemical plant owned by a French firm called Arkema. We talked about this on yesterday's program. Arkema was flooded. Arkema made chemicals and stored them on site that are called organic peroxides. Now, I'm no chemistry genius, but I know that a peroxide is something that has two bonded oxygen molecules. For instance, H2O is water. But if you bond two oxygen atoms and make it H2O2, it becomes hydrogen peroxide. Anyone who has ever brushed their teeth with hydrogen peroxide or gargled or swished with it can tell you that it is a far-fucking cry from water. All it takes is that extra molecule, that extra atom. God bless you. God bless you, Ms. Gantz. God bless you. Now, the particular peroxides that they store at the Arkema plant in Crosby, Texas, are organic peroxides. That means they contain at least a carbon atom. And some of them are hydrocarbons. In fact, the ones in question are hydrocarbons. And one of the physical properties of these peroxides, these organic hydrocarbon peroxides, is that unless you keep them really, really, really cold, they catch fire. Don't have to throw a match at it or light a fuse. It just catches fire. And of course, being a reasonable and prudent chemical firm, Arkema had backup generators. to make sure that the power stayed on for the refrigeration units that kept the peroxides cold. Until they failed. At which point, Arkema had to say, so we're going to have some explosions. And it's going to burn. And, we should probably classify these things as, you know, noxious chemicals. And then in an attempt to make it seem like a sort of no biggie chemical fire, and come on, when's the last time you heard of a no biggie chemical fire? That's right, never. They said, the effect of breathing this stuff, it's not really particularly toxic. It would be like if you stood right over a campfire and breathed. You ever tried that? Hell, have you ever sat in a really well-heated sauna? Not a sauna with chemicals on those rocks or anything, but just one so hot that it made the little hairs inside your nose sizzle and burn and whoa! And you go, well, I'm not breathing through my nose for a while I'm in here. Well, like that. Only with chemicals added in. Yeah. It's a noxious irritant. Which, interestingly, is similar to the way they classify the tear gas that gets used on protesters. And yet, they didn't. They evacuated a mile and a half radius around the plant because they knew, they didn't suspect, they said with absolute certainty at some point, shit's going to catch fire. I mean, and then when they had a press conference, they said, some enterprising reporter said, well, what about the explosion? Well, you know, we don't like to say that there was an explosion. We like to say that there was a rupture. If you want to say explosion, you're free to say explosion. But here at Arkema, we don't say explosion. We say rupture. I shit you not. I watched it. Now, my pink little ears perk up over issues like this because, well, by dint of hard experience, some of us here in the Appalachian Sacrifice Zone have had to learn a bit about this stuff. We didn't get up one morning saying, you know, I think I'm going to learn about polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons and methylcyclohexane methanol and ultrafine particulates. We didn't do that. It's just that shit started killing our friends. And neighbors, and colleagues, and even people we didn't like. People we didn't know. And we wound up having to learn about it. And so I watched the coverage today of the Arkema plant sub-disaster, a disaster within a disaster. Because if this had happened all by itself, it would have been a disaster. The fact that it's happening in a situation in which nobody can do a blessed thing about it makes it more disastrous. And while the Arkema people said, you know, we don't really expect any adverse effects out of this, none of the journalists there asking questions, and I don't fault them because they don't necessarily know about this stuff. I mean, I was sitting here tweeting, sort of begging, really, for somebody to, please, can you get your reporter on the ground to ask them about particulate counts? Ask them if they know whether this combustion of this chemical is going to result in PM10, PM2.5, or worst of all, ultrafine particulate matter. Because it's almost impossible to have fire, which at one point in time they described as, well, you know, we're going to have the same kind of big ball of fire like you would have, say, if gasoline exploded. Oh, well, that's reassuring. You're going to have oily black smoke. Okay, when you say oily black smoke, you know, smoke isn't just this, isn't just, there's a difference between, and you can ask anybody who does it, there's a difference between vapor and smoke. Some people still smoke cigarettes. Other people who used to smoke cigarettes now vape, and they think that they're probably a little bit safer because they're not inhaling particulates anymore, they're inhaling vapor. Okay, there's a difference. But what we do know, and I just, you've probably heard this before, I'm sorry, but it needs to be reinforced. If that combustion was producing ultrafine particulate matter, then every single person who breathes the shit, whether they know it or not, because that's the beauty of ultrafines, it's not like they've got a smell, they're just there, you can't see them. You may not be interested in ultrafines, but ultrafines are interested in you. And whether you can see it, smell it, touch it, taste it, feel it, there is not a single substance on earth, at least according to what I've been taught by some people who are genuine, no kidding, experts in the field, in the subject matter. There is not a single substance on earth that, when reduced to an ultrafine, is not toxic and is not carcinogenic. And so that issue still has not been addressed. And one suspects that Arkema, certainly, who must also certainly have someone within their hierarchy who knows damned well what ultrafines and fines are, has been decidedly silent on it unless something has changed dramatically in the last 2 hours. The part that made Agnes run into the studio and say, "Bob, settle down, honey. Settle down, baby. Settle down." Was when the Arkema rep said, "Oh, I quoted them at the time because it was so." Mind-boggling. I mean, I sincerely didn't really imagine that there was going to be anybody, even at corporate, who would have the brass to say something like this. Quote, "We didn't anticipate having 6 feet of water in our plant." I repeat, we didn't anticipate having 6 feet of water in our plant. As Carol Baker points out, Arkema refused to even tell reporters what's in the building and what the effects of the explosions will be. But we didn't anticipate having 6 feet of water in our plant. And it's a good thing that human beings do not have the ability to sort of the telekinesis and the ability to reach through time and space and just grab somebody by the throat. Because I'm a nonviolent person, but I really kind of wanted to. And go, well, why the hell didn't you? Do you have any idea where you are? Are you operating under the impression that you're on top of a fucking mountain? Because you're not. You're at damn near sea level. Ask any climate scientist on Earth. Give them your goddamn GPS coordinates and say, hey, you reckon we could ever expect to have 6 feet of water in our plant? And 99 out of 100 of those scientists would say, yep. You mean you haven't already? Well, you can anticipate that. You can expect that. You can plan for it. You can be guaranteed that if you start taking action to prevent 6 feet of water from getting into your plant, that those preparations will pay off someday, because it is going to happen. As sure as a little boy eating green apples is going to get a bellyache in the runs, one of these days, you're going to get 6 feet of water in your plant. It's not an if, it's a when. But there they were today. I mean, the guy looked, I mean, sort of thinnish, thin guy, respectable looking, you know, nice haircut and everything. It probably sort of... Probably one of those guys that's got dual degrees in engineering and like a, an MBA. Well, we never expected to have 6 feet of water in our plant. Jesus jumping Christ! But, of course, you can bet your ass that long before he ever went out in front of the cameras, a corporation like Arkema is going to make sure that he's had a nice little conversation with corporate counsel and the gang from risk management. And by risk management, we're not talking about the people who try to figure out how you keep 6 feet of fucking floodwater out of your plant. We're talking about the people who try to figure out how to save corporate ass once it's in there. Because it's pretty clear they didn't have anybody trying to figure out how to keep 6 feet of water out of their plant, because the guy said they never expected it. Which is what he was told to say. Oh, we never expected it. When you say we never expected it, what you're saying is we deemed it was unforeseeable. And anybody who's ever even had a cup of coffee in the first year torts class in law school knows that reasonability and foreseeability are the key to establishing liability. It has to have been reasonably foreseeable. We had no idea that we'd ever have a big old hurricane here on the Gulf Coast. Who'd have thunk of such a thing? Who would have imagined such a thing, huh? I wonder if Arkema would be allowed to site a chemical plant in as sensitive an area in France as they sited it in, you know, the Texas Gulf Coast. Probably not. But it actually, after all of this, gets worse. Because now we've gotten to the part of the Arkema story where if I had it handy, I would play the clip of, who is it, Roy Scheider in Jaws, saying, this is not a boating accident. It was helped to happen. Carol points out and reminds me of something that I thought of earlier today, too. After the West Texas explosion 3 years ago, then Attorney General, now Governor Greg Abbott, issued an edict that the plants no longer had to disclose what was in the plants under the Freedom of Information Act. They also went on to not strengthen, but weaken the safety regulations for such plants. And depending on whether or not the Arkema disaster is sufficient to make journalists curious, in the coming days and weeks, some enterprising soul will begin to dig around, and they'll find out that that plant probably hasn't been properly inspected since the French settled the Gulf Coast. Or thereabouts. But the story does get worse. Or at least the story reaches a level where it's not entirely an unforeseeable natural disaster. Because, see, not too long ago at all, according to federal records that the International Business Times reviewed, there were rules about to go into effect that had been promulgated under the Obama administration that would have actually improved safety regulations at, imagine that, chemical plants. And Earther reminds us that peroxides are fairly reactive little critters. The bathroom peroxide's only 3%. When above 50%, it's dangerous to transport, if I recall correctly. And that's hydrogen peroxide. We're not talking about, you know, carbon-bonded hydrocarbon peroxides. They burn real big. Well, anyway, those regulations, because, you know, if it had, if anything, I mean, the level of petty, pig-eyed vindictiveness on the part of the geezer disgustus regime against anything that's even vaguely associated with Barack Obama is so profound. I mean, you know, I'm surprised, well, they probably have replaced every piece of dinnerware in the White House on just on the general principle that it might have eaten from one of the plates or with one of the forks. That's how deep this runs. Well, the Trump administration went after these rules too. They were supposed to go into effect this year. And we are 8 months into this year, so there's only 4 more months, so they might have been in effect by now. The Trump regime stopped them, but only after Arkema spent a small fortune lobbying alongside the American Chemistry Council the Trump regime. And the American Chemistry Council, the International Business Times notes, with a byline from David Sirota, a chemical industry that has poured tens of millions of dollars into federal elections. Top Texas Republican lawmakers got behind the effort to stop these chemical safety plant rules. Chemical industry donors have given them a shit ton of money, too. It was as a result of the West Texas fertilizer plant explosion that killed 15 people back in 2013 that led the Obama administration to try to enhance safety standards for such chemical plants. Among other things, President Obama said he wanted an entire overhaul of the Environmental Protection Agency's risk management program. According to the EPA described the effort as saying it was seeking to improve chemical process safety, assist local emergency authorities in planning for and responding to accidents, and improve public awareness of chemical hazards at a regulated source. Okay. All of that was stopped in its tracks. Joe Barton got involved. Representative Joe Barton, Representative Pete Olson, Representative Pete Sessions, Representative Kevin Brady, all of whom voted, of course, by the way, against Sandy relief, just a reminder there. John Cornyn got involved. Ted Cruz got involved. And Arkema, well, they wrote a letter to the EPA. And they said the new rules will likely add significant new costs and burdens to the corporate audit process. In particular, they didn't like the safer technology and alternatives analysis rules. Those rules would have made companies simplify covered processes in order to make accidental releases less likely or the impacts of such releases less severe. Does that infuriate you? Because it does me. Because once again, you have Republican corporate pigs who put their donations ahead of literally the lives of their own constituents. By the way, Arkema is also a recipient of a lot of corporate welfare. They've gotten $8.7 million worth of taxpayer subsidies. Earlier this year, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration fined Arkema for more than $90,000 for 10 violations deemed serious. This is not the first time that Arkema has spewed smoke in Crosby. And it is believed, according to the Associated Press, that the Arkema plant stores massive amounts of sulfur dioxide, toxic, and methyl propane, flammable. The rules, by the way, that I mentioned, yeah, we're into August. They would have taken effect on March 14th. But Scott Pruitt, the EPA administrator, personally demanded that the rule be withdrawn. Whew. Yeah. So it's hard to say that these are accidents. Five out of six of Arkema's plants in Texas are near the Gulf Coast and in the Houston area. It's entirely possible that this may be only the first problem. And guess what? If you don't pray, you're out of luck. All you've got left after that is hope. And you're pinning your hopes on people who are more interested in their corporate profits than they are the lives of people they live around. And this is, you know, this is one plant. I'm sure there'll be plenty of corporate socialism for them in the aftermath. Arkema, by the way, also said that those new rules lacked identifiable and quantifiable benefits. Well, if you live anywhere near Crosby, Texas, you just wonder what's going to happen if you're downwind. And that's worrisome. By the way, Steve on the Gulf Coast says that same Arkema official uttered the most dangerous word anyone can imagine when the Intrepid TV reporter asked him about a half dozen times concerning toxic effects. You know the word? And it slithered noiselessly and triumphantly from his greasy, poisonous throat. Relative, he said. As in, the effects are or shall be relative. I know I feel much better now, says Steve on the Gulf Coast. And of course, that other dangerous word was probably in there too. We believe the effects are relative. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Note coming in from James. Subject line, yacht jobs at stake. Bob, God damn it, man. If the rich don't get their tax cuts, there are at least 50 jobs at stake building luxurious yachts. Barkway pointing out Miami Beach is to begin a new $100 million flood prevention project in the face of sea level rise. They're trying, but they're taking one step forward and two steps back because they're up against not only the state government, but the federal government. Steve in New York says, Sandy was a 700-year event. Harvey's a 1,000-year event. Katrina was a 150-year event for New Orleans, a 400-year event for the Mississippi Gulf Coast. How about that? Yeah. Eric in Pennsylvania, Bamistan, says, in the freedom zones of this country, the more that people build in floodplains, the higher the premiums go, and then the less able the people are to buy insurance. Following the floods and the mass exodus of the insuranceless people, the homes get bulldozed and the drainage improves. The invisible hand at work. And speaking of the free market, Carol points out the water's polluted, oil and chemical slicks everywhere, noxious gases floating in the air. There's your fucking free market, zero regulations, and the chemical companies don't have to tell anyone what's in those buildings. With no zoning laws, it can blow up schools, nursing homes, and, well, you know, anyone. To which Devin notes, God's will. Laurel asks, I'm just wondering how many coastal chemical nuclear plants on our coastlines around the world have any plans for dealing with 6 feet of water? And that is a damn fine question. See, some of this stuff about making sure that your backup generators don't fail were supposed to be lessons that were learned out of what? Why, that's right, Fukushima. You get the idea. Meanwhile, Clarence, with some sort of firsthand information, Clarence says, Bob, I'm very familiar with that plant in Crosby, Texas. I'm an over-the-road truck driver. I've hauled tons of chemicals from that facility many times. When you enter their property, you have to wear protective gear and watch a safety video before you get loaded. I always worried about an incident. always.
So we are at 5 minutes past the hour, and we'll take a little break. Jim notes, dangerous modalities, any correlation with the China syndrome? Well, not at Crosby, because you don't have one of those core on the floor situations. But what you know out of this situation is that the people who engineered and designed this plant made a disastrous assumption. They assumed that nothing would ever happen that would cause their backup generators to either fail or run out of fuel. They assumed wrongly. And once again, we see the precautionary principle enter the mix. You remember our friend, the precautionary principle? It says that you shouldn't do something until you're certain, or at least reasonably sure, you're not going to hurt a shitload of people in doing it. You can't just act on your naked, relentless, remorseless yearning for profit at the expense of the people you might kill making it.
How was that again? We didn't anticipate having 6 feet of water in our plant.
And so, once again, in another sacrifice zone, an undetermined number of people, as a result of the combustion of these hydrocarbon peroxides, an indeterminate number of people are now lifelong participants in an entirely unethical experiment to see how much of that crap they can inhale and not die real quick, or how long it takes to kill them.
Well, I tell you what, it makes you want to fire up Lee Greenwood and play God Bless the USA. If tomorrow everything I had was taken in a flood, I'd still be grateful for chemistry plants that could poison me for good, and I'm proud to live in America.
Yeah, no. No more singing. No more singing. So let's take a break. And I've got one person on hold, so we'll just wait until after that. And we'll see what's on folks' minds. Is that all right with you? It being Thursday, we've got the Green News Report on the way. Ron in Raleigh has been hitting them out of the park with bumper suggestions this week. So he sent this one along. This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
It's It's Thursday, August 31, 2017.
It's amazing. Here in 100 miles east is a disaster zone, and today we've got blue skies.
Widespread devastation in the wake of record-breaking Hurricane Harvey.
This is going to get worse before it gets better.
But the hardest work is just beginning.
A plant up near Baytown, Texas, is at risk of exploding. That is their word, not mine. It is not hyperbole.
Explosions rock flooded Texas chemical plant. Plus, looking ahead, looming battles in Congress over disaster relief and flood insurance.
All of those disasters and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Congress must ensure that a catastrophe of nature does not become a catastrophe of debt for our children and grandchildren.
Oh, hello, Congressman Mike Pence from 2005. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I realize the clear skies over Houston offer welcome relief for Houstonians, but as one meteorologist said, this is just the end of the beginning.
Yes, Hurricane Harvey continues to wreak havoc. It is now officially the worst rainfall event in U.S. history. That's according to the National Weather Service that says Harvey dumped nearly 52 inches of rain on Houston. Harvey's second landfall on Wednesday at high tide inundated the town of Port Arthur, Texas, and points east. Harvey is likely to be the costliest natural disaster in U.S. history. A third of the greater Houston region is flooded, with rescue and recovery operations ongoing. Retired Lieutenant General Russell Honoré, who led the Hurricane Katrina recovery effort, warned on CNN that the death toll will rise as more victims are found.
This is going to get worse before it gets better. We have not seen the worst of this yet. My estimate, from my experience here in America and around the world, the worst is yet to come in terms of the outcome, which means people stuck in the home and they're isolated.
In Crosby, Texas, about 30 miles northeast of Houston, on Thursday, explosions rocked the Arkema chemical plant, crippled by flooding. The plant lost backup power, critical for refrigerating volatile chemicals. The company and local police insist the materials are non-toxic, but FEMA Director Brock Long referred to the smoke plume as, quote, incredibly dangerous.
So either one or the other. Got it.
Officials are warning about long-term public health impacts, toxic pollution in the floodwaters, the high risk of mosquito and waterborne diseases, mold, and damaged roads and bridges. 32,000 people are in temporary shelters. The entire region will be grappling with the impacts of Hurricane Harvey for years. Looking ahead, members of Congress soon will return to the Capitol from August recess. They're faced with the urgent need to pass federal emergency disaster relief. The big question is whether it will become a political football.
No, not my Congress.
After Superstorm Sandy in 2012, Texas Senator Ted Cruz and House Republicans voted against disaster funding for northeastern states, falsely claiming, according to fact checkers, that the legislation was loaded with unrelated spending.
And it wasn't loaded with unrelated spending. Some of the spending would take place down the road because it takes time for officials to draw up new plans for new buildings and so forth. But Ted Cruz was absolutely wrong. And as a Houston resident, I suspect he'll have a different outlook when he comes back to Congress after the holiday.
And in 2005, after Hurricane Katrina, for the first time, Republicans demanded spending cuts in exchange for federal disaster relief funding. Here's Vice President Mike Pence back when he was an Indiana congressman.
Let's figure out how we're going to pay for it. Congress must ensure that a catastrophe of nature does not become a catastrophe of debt.
So if we can't cut elsewhere, to hell with disaster victims. Again, I think now Vice President Mike Pence may have a different outlook.
Congress also faces a deadline to reauthorize the troubled National Flood Insurance Program by September 30th. The program is $24 billion in debt due to previous flood events, and previous efforts to reform the program have been repeatedly blocked by the real estate industry, home builders, and development interests. Finally, a few weeks ago, when President Trump revoked President Obama's updated flood standards for new federal infrastructure, Trump also reinstated disaster aid rules that require rebuilding to the exact same design as before. That blocks officials from rebuilding a flooded structure, say, to a foot higher to avoid the next flood.
They have to rebuild it the same way it was. Thanks, President Trump. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, or iTunes. Find us, follow us, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
I really don't know life at all.
And so it's 19 minutes past the hour on this Thorn in the Side Thursday. I think we demonstrated the thorniness of Thorn in the Side Thursday in the filibobster. And let's run over and check in on the phone line and see who we've got. Hey, welcome to the program. Oh my God! It's Tracy after way too long. How you doing, dear?
Well, sitting here and on the freeway in 115 degree heat, you know, where there's no climate change.
Yeah, of course not. Especially not in sunny, beautiful Los Angeles.
No. Yeah, 115 degrees. Thank God I have air conditioning, but. I cannot even explain to you this heat. Plus it's humid. So we're not used to humidity out here, you know, because remember, the joke is, but it's a dry heat. No, now we have 115 degrees plus it's humid.
Since when does L.A. get humid?
Well, that's the thing. So I'm not used to this. I can't even explain it. That's the thing. I can't even explain humidity because it's not humid like the South humid. I mean, that's a whole different humidity, but it's actually humid on top of everything else. So it's fun. It's been fun. I thank God we have, you know, I don't live in my old apartment. Because we just had box air conditioner. Now we have central air in the house, but still, I mean, our electric bill is going to be ridiculous. It's times like this, I wish we had solar, but you know.
Everybody's got to have a goal.
Yeah, I'm working, you know. Speaking of which, I actually saw an Inconvenient sequel.
What'd you think?
I enjoyed it. I mean, as much as you can enjoy, you know, Al Gore.
Yeah,
but...
see, I was going to say, I don't know if that particular topic admits of being enjoyed, but you found it informative and engaging. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, that's what I should have. That's what I was looking. The words I was looking for.
I'm here to help, Tracy.
Thank you. It was informative and engaging, and former Vice President Gore really got itself worked up on a couple of things, you know, but watching it, we are informed about climate change, and watching him talk about it and watching the subject matter, it gets you pissed off.
You got to figure watching Harvey play out, Al's using all the fun words right now. And probably he's going to have to redecorate because he's probably kicked the legs off of all of his furniture.
Yeah, exactly. He's watching what's going on in Texas going, these motherfuckers here. Hey, but on a happy note, I'm still on a high because guess what I saw last night?
Yes, what?
Hamilton.
I was wondering, something was going to make me say, yeah, I wonder if she's gotten to see Hamilton yet. Was it awesome?
Oh my God! Especially watching two dark-skinned brothers play. One played Hamilton and one played George Washington.
Is Thomas Jefferson in that?
Yes.
Okay.
And he was Thomas Jefferson was a light-skinned brother with a fro. With a big old Angela Davis fro at bat.
I would love to see it. I'm not a member of the Alexander Hamilton fan club, but just for the sheer theatricality of it, I'd love to see it.
Because I'm not a history buff like you, but you being a history geek, you are a history geek, aren't you?
Badly.
Okay. You being anybody that's a history geek, you would be sitting there with your mouth agape going, you would be just, yeah.
Well, I'm not trying to diminish the theatrical experience at all, but Lin-Manuel Miranda played a little bit fast and loose with the facts.
Of course he did.
Yeah.
Of course he did. But, you know, I think anybody that can make people want to know more about history.
There, that, exactly.
I'm thinking I want to know more about Alexander Hamilton.
Might not be a terrible idea to know more about Aaron Burr, too.
Yeah, Aaron Burr. Right.
Because, he comes off as this, you know, everything short of the devil. But he may not actually have been.
That's what, and see, there's a backstory there about Burr. And about, you know, his motives, and did he really, yes. And about Jefferson and Madison and their motives and yeah, I was intrigued, and man, it was so, I mean, typically because I love the theater on top of that, so you would have enjoyed it.
Yes, I love the theater.
So you. Being a history geek and a theater geek on top of everything else, you would have been just, because I thought about you when I was watching it, I'm like, Bob needs to see this. And just the fact, like you said, because you know history, and just, to, you know, like you said, Lin-Manuel Miranda played, you know, with that, but to just see how fast and loose he played with the bat. But just to watch Hamilton, how he came up. But what I loved about it is the people of color. Because the only thing, you know me, and I'm watching two dark-skinned brothers play George Washington and Hamilton, and watching Thomas Jefferson play light-skinned brother with a fro and... just the only white person in the cast was King George. That was it. Everybody else was a person of color, Asian, Hispanic, you know, and all that. And I'm just thinking about Charlotte when I'm watching this. Instantly I'm thinking about Charlottesville and all the white supremacists and all this thing, you know, thinking about how they're, you know, white folks are being attacked. And thinking, oh my God, if they watch this, they would have cause to think that, you know, we're being erased. You know, we will not be replaced. I'm like, well, y'all just got replaced by black folks playing Washington and Hamilton and Jefferson and Madison and all that.
Well, so you're not averse to reading a book, Tracy.
No.
With that in mind, I want to recommend a book to you.
Okay.
And it speaks to the relationship between Burr and Hamilton. And it's really, really good, solid history. It's by a man named John Sedgwick, S-E-D-G-W-I-C-K.
Sedgwick?
Yeah, S-E-D-G-W-I-C-K. Okay. And it is called simply War of Two.
Sounds like a winner.
It was. I read it more than a year ago, and it just grabbed me.
And the thing is, it's fully indexed, it's annotated, and you know, what he cites can be pointed to. You know, there are real sources in here.
Nice. No, but yeah, if you get a chance, and here's the thing too. Also, I found out wherever it plays, they have an app that if you get a chance, that you can, that they do a lottery, and you can keep trying. And if you win the lottery, you could get tickets for $10 because, you know, Hamilton is on the $10 bill.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. But oh my God, I am. Do you know, here's the crazy thing. So Jan had meetings last week at her office. And I don't know how the conversation came up, but her boss, she told her boss that we had tickets to see Hamilton. Do you know her boss offered her $1,000 each for our tickets?
And you didn't sell.
Nope. Well, here's the thing. Jan being the mature... And I'm not going to say because of who's, you know, because of her religion. I'm not going to go
Tracy,
there.
Tracy, 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 Tracy.
She said it. I didn't.
Okay.
But the only reason why she didn't sell was because he left yesterday for Europe. And I'm like, are you crazy? There's no way that I would have sold those tickets. She's like, I would have sold my ticket.
And see, there I was about to make a terrible mistake and say, she didn't sell them because you have a very healthy, loving marital relationship.
No, she said she would have sold her ticket if he had, if he wasn't going to. I'm like, no. My wife, she would have taken $1,000.
No, she's just jerking your chain. That's
She said she wouldn't have sold the ticket. She said no, because she knew I would have killed her. But yeah, he actually offered us $1,000 each for our ticket.
And probably would have turned them around and sold them for $2,000 a piece.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was going to, you know, Europe. It's not like he had any use for them.
Europe. Right, and here's the thing. Did you hear about how, you know, Bruce Springsteen is having a Broadway show and that people are selling, and the scalpers are selling his tickets for $6,000 each?
Not surprising. I know.
You know. So let's talk about your homeboy, Joel Osteen.
Mine? Hold on. You can just watch that mouth.
I know you guys have been talking about him because I haven't, you know. But that motherfucker, how many times did he change his story, Bob?
Oh, look, really? I mean, are we going to discuss the propensity for truth telling of a preacher? Really? We're going to do that? Of a prosperity gospel megachurch preacher?
A prosperity gospel. Because basically, because he's saying in his gospel that if you're poor, you're poor because it's your fault. Because
God wants you to be that way until you give Joel Osteen all your money, at which point God will then make you rich, you sucker.
Yes, you sucker, you.
But let's be clear about something, because this was pointed out to me by Brother Deacon Asa last night, and it had nothing to do with mayonnaise. He said Joel Osteen is a piker compared to, say, Kenneth Copeland. Joel Osteen's only worth about $60 million. Kenneth Copeland is worth $750 million.
What?
And it's all tax free.
Well,
hallelujah.
It's all tax free. Hallelujah. Wow. We're in the wrong business, Bob.
Oh, I know. I can't tell anybody that I've got the secret to make sure that they're not dead when they're dead. It's just, you know, it ain't in me.
I cannot you know, and I'm a Christian, you know, and I believe in, you know, Jesus. And but what I don't believe is, you know, taking people for everything they got. I don't believe
there are those out there in the religion industry who read that verse that says, feed my sheep. And they assume that there's a parenthetical after that one that was written in, like, invisible Aramaic ink that says, and then shear the fuck out of them.
Fuck out of them. Right. And so now we got Joel Osteen finally opening his doors and trying to say, well, first he says that it was flooded. Then he said that
nobody told us we might be needed. I mean, you know, what? It's just a 1,000-year flood. I mean, you know, and we've just got a big basketball arena. I mean, you know.
Right, you know. But then we had the mosque.
You have any idea what the power bill is for a 17,000-seat basketball arena church?
Right. Right. You know, but we have the Muslim terrorists, you know, opening their mouth for 24 hours.
Well, yeah, the synagogue, yeah. Early on, the first doors to open were the synagogues and the mosques.
Right.
Okay, I've got a little cowbell for Hoghead in the chat room. Hoghead just pointed out, Osteen wanted to get plastic slip covers on the furniture first before he let those people in.
Right.
And then, of course, there'd have to be a full reconsecration because it'd been full of sinners.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe even, you know what? There might have been some Homer sectionals come there for help.
True. And then, you know, in the midst of all that, you know, your other homie, Ted, what did he call him? Booger Eater?
Well, that's one more.
You know, saying that, you know, asking for money because, you know, Texas, and thinking that people are going to forget that he said no to Hurricane Sandy.
I know. So let me ask you, how, you know, we miss you, honey, when we don't hear from you. How have you been? I mean, I saw that you were having some surgery and...
Yeah, I'm doing better. I overdid it. I forget that I'm not in my 20s anymore and that I can't lift stuff after surgery. I didn't lift anything. I had to go back to work because, you know, I don't have paid time off because I work for myself. And so I did too much the other day, and the pain pills don't really work, and I don't really want to take too many because I don't want to become a statistic and get hooked on opioids.
Right.
Because the opioid epidemic doesn't count if you're black.
That's true. I didn't think about it that way, but that's true.
It doesn't count if you're black.
Yeah, that's just being black. I mean, that's just being black, right? I mean, you know.
Right, you know. So I've been...
You, Miles Davis, Billie Holiday.
Right, you know, Billie Holiday, stuff like that. And I can't use... And see, I'm not a musician either, so...
If you're gonna take your opioids, you at least have to get a fucking kazoo, okay?
Right. I can't sing. I can't play an instrument. I can't dance. So all those black stereotypes. So the only black stereotype would fit is if I was hooked on crack. And since that's not an old, you know, so I'm fucked.
Yeah, crack, so, you know, crack is so, you know.
So it's 1980.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
So the surgery went well. The good news is, when I had my MRI, he saw a bone, you know, because of a bone scar, and so he was still concerned because, you know, he warned me that, you know, just because it showed on the MRI that it was a bone scar, that when he went in, it could still be, you know, rotator cuff damage, tendon damage, you know, there could still be more. because sometimes everything doesn't show on an MRI. Fortunately, when he went in, it was just a bone spur. So the surgery took all of 15 minutes, arthroscopic surgery. When I went back last Thursday for the post-operative review, everything was fine. I'm out of the sling. I start physical therapy next week. Jan and I are going away for the weekend, going to Rincon because I need to get my Jones going for, you know, it's been 2 months. I haven't been to the casino, so you know. And you only need one arm for the slot machine.
You only need one arm for the one arm bandit. I mean, yeah.
Right.
Although it's just, it's just buttons now, though, right? I mean, there's no actual.
Right, it's just buttons. It's just buttons. I'm going to Portland in 2 weeks to visit my sister. She conned me into going, to coming up there for a girls' weekend with her cousins, not mine. And I'll keep trying to remind her that my last name is Porter, not Penson, but, you know. And it was funny because Jan's like, my wife is so funny. She's like, Rachel's like, well, Jan could come. And I'm like, really? Jan in a house full of black women? And Jan's like, well, do you want me to go? I said, it's not that I don't want you to go. But I don't know how comfortable you're going to be with a whole bunch of black women. Because as much as I love my wife, she can be kind of like, she can, the Archie.
You're afraid of the moment of privileged cluelessness, aren't you?
Yes. And the Archie Bunker in her comes out as a, and I don't want to have to explain her to anybody. And yes, I like, how did you say it? The coolest privilege? Yeah.
Privileged cluelessness.
So, privileged
cluelessness.
And
I mean, it can happen so easily. It can be as simple as a casually dropped you people.
You people, or those people. And it's like.
Or, I mean, I assume by virtue of having had a couple of years under her belt of living with you, she's not going to walk up and, like, you know, touch anybody's hair or anything.
No. And you know, because I told you, when we first started dating, she did ask, so how do you, and this is a direct quote, how do you people wash your hair?
And it was love at first sight.
Yeah, I mean, instantly, I'm like, cool. And see, again, these little things where, you know, knowledge is power, and you have to teach people, and you have to choose who you're going to teach and who you're going to kick to the curb. And I chose to teach because I love her. And I knew she didn't mean it.
Right. So you we're just not going to do that anymore.
Right. We're not going to say those you people, and we're not going to ask, you know, because my response was, because you know me well enough to know how I responded. I'm like, so you turn on the water.
You get your head wet.
You know, you get your head wet, and, you know, and you put both shampoo in your hair, in your hand, and then you lather, rinse, and repeat. And then as soon as I said that, she realized what an idiot she was. And so, you know, the things that, you know, because I told her, so we had, when we first got together, I said, we're going to have an Ask a Negro moment. So all those questions that you wanted to ask black people, this is your chance to ask all those stupid questions that you've always, those burning questions that you've always had. And so now you get a chance to ask them. And now once you've asked them, we're done. You will never be able to ask them again. So this is your mulligan. That's the mulligan. That's the golf term. That's what the mulligan means, right? You get that one chance. And then after that, you're done.
Well, a mulligan is a do-over.
A do-over. Okay, so whatever. See, that's about as much as I know about golf. So, you know, then we don't, you know, we're done. You don't, you get the one chance, and that's it. So, yeah. So that's it. So how was your vacation? That's the last time I talked to you. Last time I talked to you, you were trying to figure out if you can raise enough money to go on vacation.
We went. It was all too short. But I got to satisfy my barbecue Jones.
I did see a couple things about barbecue.
Yes. I got to see the Gulf of Mexico. I got to show Agnes I got to show Agnes New Orleans, which was...
You went to New Orleans? I didn't realize you were going to New Orleans.
Well, I mean, we were...
Did you fly or did you drive?
Drove.
Okay.
Stopped off in my hometown for a memorial for my best friend who had just died.
I'm sorry.
Well, he was a thoughtful fella. He was kind enough to... Well, I mean, it worked out scheduling-wise, which is a horrible thing to say, but I would have gone under any circumstance, but yeah, it did. And so we left there and then got down to the Gulf Coast and hung out with family and then just drove over. I found a wonderful little hotel a couple of blocks off Canal Street with a lot of history to it. It was around the corner from Mother's on Poydras, which made it even better.
You went to Mother's.
Oh, yeah.
You went to Mother's.
Of course. That evening. The evening we got there. And then got called by MSNBC, so I wound up going over to a TV studio there to do All In with Chris Hayes. And then we got up the next morning. We called in because one of the beautiful things about New Orleans is you can get awesome food in the middle of the night without having to step out of your hotel.
Yes, you can.
Yeah, I mean, they'll bring you...
Just had a couple of times.
They will bring you anything. They will bring you liquor. They will bring you beer. They will bring you cigarettes, cigars.
Yes.
Yes, they will.
They will bring you liquor in the middle of the goddamn night.
All of which I could not do. But we did order in some, I violated some food rules, and so far have lived to tell the tale.
How's your stomach?
Holding up, got through it, it was okay, moderation in all things, and the next morning we got up and, well, that night I took Agnes on the obligatory walk down Bourbon Street.
Of course you had to do that.
And it was not much fun at all because Bourbon Street was torn all to hell. They've got the street torn up for the first three blocks. So Bourbon Street was just deader than a bag of Egyptian doornails. she didn't think it was dead. And I was like, oh yeah, it's dead. But I got her to the oldest bar on Bourbon Street. I took her in there, and she drank a Planter's Punch.
She have a hurricane?
She tasted one. She thought it far too sweet. I got her one of those slurpy hurricanes, and she just didn't like it at all. And then the next morning, and then we went back to the hotel, at which point she said she was hungry. We both agreed, you know, you don't eat on Bourbon Street.
No.
And so we ordered in and had some delicious food. You know, it's the best delivery food probably in America. Then the next morning we got up and we were leaving. We were going to leave about noon, 1 o'clock. So we got up early and we wandered through the quarter and just saw the quarter by daylight, decided we were not going to stand in line at Cafe Du Monde for an hour and a half for a cup of coffee and a beignet, and went back up the street.
An hour and a half? Really?
Oh, it was crazy. The line was forever.
And went back up about a block and a half to a place that didn't have great coffee, but still had good beignets, and had a nice little jazz combo playing as a bonus in the middle of the week. And then we walked through the quarter, at which point this really, really cool, wonderful waiter at Antoine's reached out and called her inside and gave us a tour of Antoine's, which thrilled her to no end. Yeah. Because I, meanwhile, was having my Bugs Bunny moment. I think I even posted it on Facebook or something, the whole Back Bay Bunny Bayou Bordelaise a la Antoine's. And then we jumped, and then we got back to the hotel, jumped in the car, and went back to Mobile. But we had a wonderful time. And
I am so glad, because when's the last time you've been on vacation?
12 years ago.
Holy shit! So I think you would do 12 years ago.
Yeah.
My God.
And you know, we're already thinking about how we're going to do this, but next May is our 25th anniversary.
No, it is Alex's 30th birthday. Hey, you want to come with us to Cuba?
That sounds awesome. Sounds awesome.
I'm planning a cruise. I'm planning a cruise to Cuba. When are we leaving?
If that's still legal by then.
Oh, don't say it. I got people booked on this cruise, Bob. Don't.
Did you buy the travel insurance? That it might include stupid things. I mean, you'd have to check the riders and everything, but I'd definitely buy the stupid things that Trump might do, rider.
That motherfucker. Do you know we went this whole phone call without even mentioning him?
I know, but it's almost impossible to avoid.
Oh my God. So yeah, because Alex will be 30 next year. And his birthday is the same day as your wedding anniversary.
Yes. So actually what I was thinking I would love to do, and I don't know if this is even possible, but you gotta have goals. I'd like to go down and find a place at the Gulf and rent it for a month, and take the mobile rig with me and keep doing the program every night. But, you know, like do the program for a week, take a week off, do the program for a week, take a week off, come home.
Or something
something like that would afford some opportunity to, because my God, I think we put near 3,000 miles on that on the rental vehicle, and trust me, Tracy, you don't ever want to spend 3,000 miles in a Nissan Sentra.
Were you in a Sentra?
Yes.
Oh my God, your ass must be raw.
I was pretty beat up.
That's too small of a car. When Janet and I would do our little road trips, we were in like a Ford Edge, you know, something.
Well, for another for like another $10 a day, I could have had a Ford Focus Hybrid. But it wasn't
that would have been more comfortable.
But it wasn't that much bigger, and it wasn't that much more comfortable.
Really?
Yeah. Apparently, unless I'm in some sort of like, at least midsize crossover vehicle, or a, you know, something in like, you know, Nissan Maxima, Chevy Malibu, you know, something along in there. Because I mean, I had the seat all the way back, and I, you know,
how tall are you, Bob?
6'2".
Okay, so you got some height on you.
Yeah, 6'2". You know, 6'2", 220. But it, yeah, just no.
Yeah, I'm planning a siblings weekend next year with me and my siblings. Hopefully for New Orleans next March. Well, it was funny because I was thinking about March, right? And then Jan pointed out, she's like, "Wait a minute, you're gonna go to New Orleans without me?" And then have the nerve to go in my birthday month? Are you fucking kidding? I said, well, we're going, because see, we're going in 2019, and for my mom's 70th birthday, we're planning a cruise for her around Thanksgiving, because her birthday is in November. So I was going to do a Thanksgiving cruise for her 70th birthday. And the same cruise that Jen and I did 2 years ago, that leaves out of New Orleans, it goes to Honduras, Belize, Cozumel, and Costa Maya. And I said, but we're going to New Orleans then, right? And she's like, but, so I kind of talked her down on that. But she, you know, she's like, how dare you? And I said, but honey, it's, yeah, so I might not be able to do that. So I might have to just ixnay on that one. But I really want to, you know, because see, she doesn't like, she doesn't get the concept that I actually like my siblings. Because her brother's such an asshole. So she can't even imagine wanting to go somewhere with her brother and spend time with him. So she doesn't get it, you know? So I you know, so she doesn't get that idea of spending time with her brother. So there you go. So, but I'm so glad, you know, oh, speaking of traveling, Jan and I think I told you that we're going on a cruise in December.
No, really?
I think I told you.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're leaving out of Puerto Rico. Remember, the stops are Barbados, St. Thomas, St. Kitts, Martinique, and St. Martin.
Oh, yeah. That's a nice ride.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited. I can't wait. I'm looking forward to it, because I've never been to Puerto Rico. Oh my God! And because of the travel, because I'm back doing travel again. I got room. Are you ready for this? At the Intercontinental San Juan for $250 for two nights.
Not shabby.
In San Juan. Yes. $250. And with tax, it's $280. And I'm going, wait, what? So yeah, I'm so excited. I cannot wait. It's free Wi-Fi, the whole thing. I cannot wait. You know how you just kind of just, you just need to get a, well, you know, I mean, I cannot believe it's been 12 years since your last vacation. You need to start getting away more.
It would be nice, but things kind of fall apart here when I do, so.
Well, I think that's an awesome idea. Where would you stay on the Gulf? Mississippi or New Orleans?
The Redneck Riviera, Lower Alabama. It's it's just my favorite place.
Did you say the red? I thought Myrtle Beach was the Redneck Riviera.
No. That's Gulf Shores, Orange Beach, Dauphin Island, Perdido Key, that kind of stuff. But you know, just go down there.
Well,
because one of these days I'm going to go down. I'm actually going to find a way to sit down and start writing stuff. I gotta write stuff too. And oh well, but you know. Who knows? Who knows? Who knows how it's going to play out? But it's certainly a goal.
Well, if anybody can do it, you can.
Well, I'd like to hope so.
Because, you know, you're fucking amazing, by the way.
Well, thank you. Thank you very kindly. Agnes, well, it's a good thing Agnes didn't hear you say that, or I'd have a bucket of cold. I'd be wearing a bucket of cold water by now to keep my head from swelling.
Oh, well, you know, she knows you are. That's why she's been married to you for 24, going on 25 years. So if she didn't think you were amazing, from what I know about Agnes, if she didn't think you were amazing, she wouldn't be bothered.
I think there's probably a lot of truth in that. But she's stuck. And that's the thing. The whole trip, like I told everybody before, we were actually alone together. For longer than we ever have been in our entire marriage. And the nice thing was, we found out that we really do like each other and enjoy each other's company.
And there you go. Well, on that note, I'm going to hang up because I know there's other people that want to talk. And you, I've missed you guys.
Oh, I'm so
I promise I won't stay gone.
Yeah, it just, you know, we worry. Just stay in touch. Okay.
I will.
And I hope you guys, I hope you break the house at Rincon.
I hope I do too. Have a good rest of the night.
All right, you take care, Tracy. Bye now.
Okay, bye.
The one and only Tracy, the lady cab driver calling from somewhere on the 405 or the 509 or the 6 7/8 in the wilds of 63% humidity, Los Angeles. Yeah, Laurel looked that up for us. Dew point in LA is 63 degrees. The dew point in Houston right now, it's also 63 degrees. How about that? I feel the same way. Steve in New York says, great to hear from Tracy. And I'm taking grief from Marty. No stop at the Café du Monde. Blasphemy. We should cast you out or smite you or something. From Q, the episode Tapestry, obligatory Star Trek reference. Thank you. We should cast you out or smite you or something. Well, we stopped. Marty, we stopped. We stopped at the Café du Monde. I had every intention of going in, getting coffee and beignets, but it was an hour and a half wait. The line was way out the door and forever. So, you know, we brought some Café du Monde coffee home, but we did have hot beignets a little up the street, and they were very, very good beignets. But, you know, she saw the place. But it was real hard to get her to agree to sort of stick around, because if you're familiar with the area of Decatur Street where Jackson Square is, across the street, there's a few steps up, and then you see the cannon emplacements, the gun emplacements, that guarded oldie New Orleans. And, you know, Mississippi River, whatever. And way miles up the river, a really impressive, because, you know, it's so flat, a really impressive, really long bolt of lightning just went. And Agnes grabbed me and said, back to the hotel, we're leaving now. And I stood my ground. And I said, no, no, no. That was miles up the river. And if that's going to get us, then something else will too. I don't know when I'm going to be able to bring you back to New Orleans. So we continued to walk on through the quarter, and she eventually got her tour of Antoine's, and we saw the sacred beret in Antoine's, the sacred beret that Groucho Marx he left it at the table when he dined there. They sent it back to him, and he sent it back to them, and it's now part of their little mini museum. And you know, I'm not much for religious iconography, but I can get real worked up about Groucho Marx's beret. Yeah, so the phone line is open if anybody else wants to jump in. There are a couple of things that I wanted to touch on along the way. Don't know if you're aware of this, but Donald J. Trump has pledged $1 million personally to Hurricane Harvey recovery in and around Houston. This pledge, of course, is not worth the air it took him to speak it. Because, see, back in 2012, when his own hometown, New York, and the surrounding area had the living bejesus bashed out of it by Superstorm Sandy, Trump also pledged money for the recovery. He pledged it to Mary Pat Christie, wife of Governor Chris Christie. He said, how much does the check need to be? Just tell me and I'll send it.
Never sent a penny to the charity that never sent a penny to the charity that Mary Pat Christie was heading. And of course, this is all in line with all the work that David Farenthold did over at the Washington Post, in which he noted that, for instance, the $1 million that Trump pledged to a veterans group never showed up. Well, actually, after David Farenthold began pointing it out, and other reporters, that he finally ponied up. He's a blowhard. And of course, I would be doing a disservice if I didn't note on this Thorn in the Side Thursday that there's still stuff screwing up in other parts of the country. I'm thinking particularly of, in this case, of course, Georgistan. Yeah. Last night we had the story of the Georgia Republican member of the House of Representatives who tried to threaten an African-American former legislator into not taking the campaign to remove Confederate memorials into South Georgia. Well, this story comes out of Cobb County, and I'll bet you dollars to donuts that Steve from Georgistan is already well aware of this one, because it's getting quite a bit of play down Georgia way for obvious reasons. It's the story of Cobb County Police Lieutenant, not patrolman, Lieutenant. This is somebody with some considerable experience on the force. Cobb County Police Lieutenant Greg Abbott. Different Greg Abbott. Cobb County Police Lieutenant Greg Abbott had pulled over someone on suspicion, a woman, had pulled over a woman on suspicion of DUI. And she was making sure that her hands were in full view and she was keeping them on the steering wheel. At the same time that the officer, Lieutenant Greg, Cobb County Police Lieutenant Greg Abbott, was asking to see her license and registration, which is, you know, the first two questions a cop asks you on a pullover. She was also not black. Okay, this is going to become important. Well, they have. They don't have body cams, apparently, yet in the Cobb County, Georgia Police Department, but they do have dash cams. And the dash cams have audio. And WSB TV Channel 2 Atlanta got the story. This, then, is the audio and a part of WSB's report.
An officer's words when a woman says she was afraid to move her hands.
Remember, we only kill black people. Yeah, we only kill black people, right?
That's exclusive dash cam video. New at 6, the officer is trying to explain himself.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and listen to the rest of the breaking action news.
Live, local, late breaking. This is Channel 2 Action News at 6 p.m. Coverage you can count on.
Good evening, I'm Justin Farm.
I'm Jovita Moore. Only Channel 2 Action News got dash cam video of a DUI stop. Now, we want you to listen because it's the officer's words, not his actions here, that have him under an internal investigation. Channel 2's investigative reporter, Mark Winnie, is live at Cobb County Police Headquarters. And Mark, the officer's attorney says he was only trying to get that woman to comply.
Yeah, in fact, we were led to believe the officer was eager, in fact, to tell his side to go on camera, but his attorney intervened. We do, however, have a detailed statement from that attorney. But first, the video.
Or use your phone. It's in your lap
okay,
right there.
I just don't want to put my hands down. I'm really sorry. I'm
just... You're just wrong.
No. I've just been wasting any videos.
But you're not black. Remember, we only kill black people. Yeah, we only kill black people, right? All the videos you've seen, have you seen black people get killed? You have.
The statements was made by an individual, and they're not indicative of the values and the facts that surround the Cobb County Police Department and this county in general.
I'm so glad to know that. So you've only got one terrible racist cop in the Cobb County Police Department. I really wish that was some sort of terribly conceived and executed comedy routine. It wasn't. That was real. The pettifogger in question, who was probably paid for by the cop union, said he was attempting to de-escalate a situation involving an uncooperative passenger. In this context, his comments were clearly aimed at attempting to gain compliance by using the passenger's own statements and reasoning to avoid making arrest. No. Just no. WSB had to go to the time and expense of actually filing a Freedom of Information Act request before they got their hands on the dash cam footage. And I guess that's probably understandable, given how terrifyingly real this is. So there's an internal investigation underway. Anybody want to explain what there is? Help me here. Anybody want to explain to me what is needed in the way of investigation? Lieutenant Abbott, is that your voice? Yeah. Lieutenant Abbott, is that you? Lieutenant Abbott, did you actually say we only kill the black people? Did you say that, Lieutenant Abbott?
Well, yeah, but I was just trying to de-escalate a potentially dangerous situation in which somebody I wasn't going to shoot because she wasn't black. Oh, wait a minute, I didn't mean to say it that way. Damn it. I think I need a lawyer.
Tell me, please, the right way to say we only shoot black people. And I don't mean like, you know, say it with a different accent or in a different language. So it's maybe you're trying to diffuse a tense hostage situation. No, come on out, sir. You're white as the driven snow. It's obvious we're not going to blow you away the minute you're through the door and let go all of your hostages. After all, we only kill black people. That? Nah, because see, I couldn't make that work there either. One of those 24 situations where the terrorist has the suitcase nuke hidden somewhere in greater Atlanta, and only Kiefer Sutherland can prevent the nuke from going off. Oh, no, we're not gonna kill you. Just tell us where the bomb is. No, we're not gonna kill you. Remember, we only shoot black people. Nah, because that's 24, and that's bullshit.
So instead of being fired outright, you know, because he's got rights, he's in the cop union. Instead of just being fired out, Police Lieutenant Greg Abbott was put on administrative leave. You know, he put on a paid vacation. Until the Cobb County Police Department can determine that there are some situations in which you can say we only shoot black, in which a police officer can say we only shoot black people. Right? Yeah. No. One of these days, we got to have a long talk with this country. Okay, it is apparently not... well, then why did I just see it today? Steve tells me it goes back to 2016. Surprised I missed that. I'm just curious now. Dateline, August 31st, 2017. Okay, the video is shot on 7/10/2016. Yeah, the story goes back to 2016. Apparently, WSB, however, just got the footage. And the latest update to the WSB story says the recommendation is to fire Lieutenant Greg Abbott. Well, that's reassuring. So, okay, thanks for that update, Steve. It takes from 2016 to 2017 for the Cobb County, Georgia Police Department to even recommend that a cop be fired for saying, we only shoot black people. Well, howdy do. I mean, well, justice delayed and all of that, right? Breathe, Steve. Breathe, Steve in New York. Values, Cobb County, are you effing kidding me? Yeah. Steve from Georgia Stan pointing out the only reason they're saying that, Bob, is because he got caught. Ay, ay, ay. Yeah, I don't think it was a language problem there, Arthur. We only ex-life escape African American. Nope, sorry. But remember, not all cops, right? But some cops, definitely some cops. This is one of those goddess of irony moments. It was a week or so more, a little over, I guess it'll be 2 weeks now, that I was given a little bit of the travel log from the once every 12 years vacation. And I told you all about a guy named George Colbert. half Scots, half Chickasaw. Very, very rich man. Got removed to Oklahoma. Colbert County, Alabama is named after him. He was a slave owner. The place where his stand was on the Natchez Trace actually had any references to slaves erased from the interpretive marker there. Well, as the goddess of irony would have it, he was removed from Indian lands in the southeast and removed to Oklahoma, where he became, again, in his old age, became fabulously wealthy once more. And the town of Colbert, Oklahoma, was named after him. And so, lo and behold, the town of, after I sit there talk, for nothing connected to this whatsoever, I'm talking about George Colbert, the history of the name, Colbert, Oklahoma, and then, boom, news story out of Colbert, Oklahoma. Not all cops, just some cops. And if it's just one cop, it's still too many cops. Colbert, Oklahoma is a little town there. They got a police chief. The police chief's name is Bart Asbrook. KXII reporter Rachel Knapp broke the story when she started looking at the Southern Poverty Law Center's hate map. And she found a dot at Texoma. And that's when she found out that, well, the police chief of Texoma, or of Colbert, Oklahoma, Bart Asbrook, runs a website called ISD Records and had signed off on the paperwork in 2004 to found the website for it. This is all in the wake of Charlottesville. And has, as noted last night with the restaurant in the Bay Area, led people to start looking around trying to find out who their local neighborhood Nazis and Klansmen are. And so Rachel Knapp of KXII started digging around and found Bart Asbrook, who runs a website that, sells white supremacist stuff. You know, things like, Hitler Youth, KKK stuff, SS stuff, swastika stuff, Confederate flag stuff. And the chief said, "Oh, that ain't me. I got my wallet stolt back in the 1990s after a heavy metal concert, and I got in a fight, and some skinheads they took in my wallet, and they started using my name." Interestingly, immediately after the KXII reporter, Rachel Knapp, called to ask Bart Asbrook, who was the interim police chief of Colbert, Oklahoma. Did I mention that? Yeah, police chief. Interim police chief.
He offered up that my wallet done got stolen, my identity's been stolen since the 1990s. They stole it from me, the skinheads did, and started using my good name. But, well, Rachel Knapp didn't ask anybody else but him about it. And lo and behold, a couple hours after she started asking questions, the website done disappeared. Then they started looking around, and it turns out Bart Allsbrook has a rap sheet in which at one point in time he was charged with attempted murder, but the charge was dropped a little bit later. And then she dug around some more and found out that the Southern Poverty Law Center back in 2005 had noted that Blood and Honor USA's Texas coordinator was Bart Allsbrook. And he'd even traveled to Ohio for a Blood and Honor meeting with skinhead groups from at least 8 states. Among other things, you can buy a Combat 18 patches at ISD Records. Those things are that's one of those icons that they, you know, masturbate over if you're a skinhead, and are all wrapped up with the Blood and Honor movement among skinheads. They like their number thing. 18 is a number that it's sort of a secret high sign, meaning Adolf Hitler. And, you know, they're not just some get-together in the basement and circle-jerk skinheads. According to the BBC, throughout the 1990s, Combat 18 engaged in terrorism and violence, not the least of which was, you know, arson. Music on ISD Records includes songs like Hitler Was Right and Start Up the Panzers. Now, I'm sure that Bart Allsbrook is only suffering from economic anxiety. But still, it would appear that he's a Klansman neo-Nazi skinhead, or some variation on the theme. This is where it gets more interesting. So he's police chief of Colbert, Oklahoma. The story goes all over that he's police chief of Colbert, Oklahoma. Not all cops, just a few of them. And so he tenders his resignation to the city parents. I don't know if there are any city mothers, but there are city fathers of Colbert, Oklahoma. And the town officials have refused to accept the resignation. According to Rachel Knapp, quote, in Colbert, the general consensus from citizens is that they were surprised and outraged and wanted interim police chief Bart Allsbrook to resign. But a city official said they want to keep him. That view is different from the citizens they serve. One African-American man interviewed by KXII said, I sure wouldn't want him stopping me. I don't know anywhere in history where the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists have ideas and thoughts where they don't infringe on the rights of other people, especially the people of color. And it's kind of blowing up all over Colbert. Because now it's not just a call for Allsbrook to resign or to be fired, but to get rid of the people who hired him. John Poss, a former Colbert city councilman, said, when you have individuals on the council who do not do their homework, who are plainly not in this particular case, they need to resign, and they need to resign today. Uh-huh. And the SPLC then released more in-depth
investigating and reportage about Chief Allsbrook as a major hate leader. Combat 18's nickname, it is reported, is the Terror Machine. And there's a photograph that was found by the Southern Poverty Law Center of a masked man, balaclava over his head, wearing a black T-shirt that says Terror Machine, Combat 18, and holding a semi-automatic military-style rifle. And the person in the picture seems to have tattoos that are identical to those of the fella who is in the black and white photo, which takes us to St. Louis, Missouri, where a CrossFit trainer was recently discovered by virtue of his tattoos. Where's your tattoo? You don't got no tattoo. Unscannable. Was discovered by virtue of his tattoos to have been a participant in the Charlottesville hate rallies. He has subsequently been dismissed from his position as a CrossFit trainer, causing, of course, the usual outcries of how he is being discriminated against because he's not a white supremacist. He just wants to make sure that there's a place in the future for white Europeans. Whew. Oh, and by the way, now that things are, they're not settling down, but now that things are, now that it's quit raining in Houston, the white wing militias have begun walking the flooded streets. They're walking the flooded streets with guns. They are not needed. But, lo and behold, the Oath Keepers, who are a white-wing paramilitary outfit, put out a call for their members to bring boats and any with first aid experience, and, of course, they bring guns. Problem is, Houston is already being patrolled by a different group of white-wing militia, also carrying guns, called the Proud Boys. And there are photographs of them on Twitter. Atlanta anti-fascists posted the photo of a bunch of not particularly intimidating white rednecks standing in water about half shin deep, and all of them, except one, are carrying some form of deadly weapon, to wit, a Freedom Protector gun. The Proud Boys, what do you reckon they're proud of, huh? What do you guess? Why, they're proud of their whiteness. And so here's a thing that I just learned. I didn't know this. This is one of those cultural things I hadn't picked up on because, you know, I don't necessarily every day go to check out what new bizarre lodge signs the goddamn Klan skinhead neo-Nazi assholes have come up with lately. I knew about 88. I didn't know about 18. I knew about the 7 words or whatever, but I can't tell you what they are offhand. But these clowns, the Proud Boys, are standing in this photograph. And you know the OK sign? Like, you go back to the old SNLs of the days when the young Eddie Murphy was still carving out his space in the comedic universe. And he'd do buckwheat, and he'd hold up the index finger touching his thumb and do, O-tay. Remember that? God, it was funny. Well, that symbol has come back, only if you do it with your, and you're holding it out for everybody to see. If you hold it with your left hand out for everybody to see, it, you know, looks like the letter O and the letter K. Okay. But because we have a Nazi problem, because we have a Klan problem, because fully one-third of the Republican base, the hardcore, dead-enders, hard cases, Trump supporters that we now refer to as maggots, make America great again, Trumpansy scum, because we have maggots, and because we have quiet little collaborators and facilitators that probably make the Republican base at least 50% and possibly more white supremacist, neo-Nazi, Klansmen, sympathizers, collaborators, we've got a new symbol. Like, these assholes. Because if you make the OK symbol with your right hand instead of your left, remember, right rhymes with white. If you make the OK symbol and you hold your hand straight up, then it goes from looking, someone looking toward you, it goes from looking like OK to looking like WP, which stands, of course, for white power. Got it? And these Proud Boys, with their various freedom protectors, are all standing in the photo, all but one. Some of them get it right. You know, there's always one dumbass who gets it wrong. There's one guy holding up his left hand as okay. But the rest of them get it right, and they're holding up their right hands, palms outward, in the what is now white power symbol. You see, they're constantly searching for ways to manifest their hate without being overt. So this isn't about me, like, you know, playing Beatles albums backwards or anything. Turn me on, white man. Turn me on, white man. Turn me on, white man. Okay? This is real. So Houston now has another problem. Houston has a white supremacy problem. Because a group of white supremacist punk pissants, who are incidentally heavily armed, well, they're walking around the flooded streets of Houston, ostensibly to prevent looting. Now bear in mind, the only people that the Proud Boys or the Oath Keepers are going to see are, of course, people of color. And so, it will be something on the order of a miracle if one of these skinhead Klansmen, neo-Nazi, white supremacist pissants doesn't wind up murdering some innocent person of color. Or murder some non-innocent person. Because, see, it's not for them to judge who's innocent and who's not. Stop! Put down the food you're carrying! How can you prove that you didn't loot that? Bang! Yeah. Because it's everywhere. Hell, it's in Portland. We already know that from the incident a couple of months back, in which murder was committed when rescuers stepped in to prevent an attack against Muslim women. Well, up in the Portland area, there's a street preacher a hardcore right-wing white wing street preacher by the name of Alan Puckett. Is promising violence at future neo-Nazi, Klansmen, bigot, you know, etc. rallies. And, of course, he hates everybody. He hates Jews, he hates people of color, he hates lesbians, gay people, transgendered, bisexuals. Everybody, he hates everybody who doesn't, you know, exactly agree with him and probably has problems with some of the people. He hates everybody who isn't him. Probably hates himself. So he joins that long list, or lengthening list, of people who are aching, who are yearning for blood to run in the streets. He's apparently at least loosely associated with the Patriot Prayer Group. On Facebook, he said, anybody unwilling to engage in violence needs to stop organizing and attending rallies. Any movement forward in the future will inevitably have bloodshed. Those not willing need to stop organizing and attending rallies. God's going to wipe them out one day anyway. In downtown Portland, come September 10th, I'm sure our buddy the Angry Indian is already aware of this. Come September 10th, there's a Freedom March planned. As announced by Joey Gibson of Patriot Prayer, it's going to be at the Salmon Street Springs in downtown Portland. That will probably not go well. the ACLU, the ACLU, which said that it would no longer defend Nazis and hate mongers. Apparently, the ACLU of Oregon didn't get the message. And they said, the First Amendment protects the exchange of ideas unless it is likely to produce imminent lawless action. This test protects all kinds of harmful, intimidated, and disturbing speech. The same test protects the rights of the rest of us to speak out against that vile speech. Meanwhile, engaging in free speech, Alan Puckett says, peace has never been an option. Too many naive people who need to wake up to the reality that the violent understand nothing but victory or defeat through violence. I'm not even sure that's a real sentence, but still, he said it. And since Patriot Prayer announced their freedom rally, at least three counter-protests have already been announced by the Queer Liberation Front, Portland Stands United Against Hate, and Rose City Antifa. I'm going to mark the calendar. And this Puckett asshole is another one of those people who runs around telling people who's going to burn in hell and, you know. And of course, he'll be in heaven. There's the question. Who wants to go to a heaven that's got the likes of an Alan Puckett in it? So let's stay with the theme. Let's run down to Albuquerque, New Mexico. And a high school there. Yep. Two students at the high school there have been suspended for 10 days. One of them was kicked off the football team. They're serious. Because the two students posted a photo on the high school's official Snapchat page, account, whatever. I don't use Snapchat. What they did is they took a photograph of a class. And with the exception of two young black women, they superimposed Klan hoods and masks on everybody else in the classroom. Even people who weren't facing the camera have Klan hoods facing the camera. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 people with Klan hoods on them and two young black women. The mother of one of the students says it was awful. It was frightening. I just got really sick at my stomach. I was afraid for my daughters and for the other children there. They're at risk for these types of threats. One of the girls' father said, you don't expect your kids going to school and having to deal with racism and discrimination in 2017. It's kind of appalling. Meanwhile, when the kids, the two kids, they're just kids, they're just playful kids, were confronted about it, they said, well, heck, it was just a joke. And it raises the question, what do? These are children. 10-day suspension seems appropriate. Kicking one of them off the football team. Okay. But the Albuquerque Public Schools Superintendent Raquel Reedy told KOB Channel 4, we took this to our police department. They came and investigated and are really looking very carefully at whether we should file charges for hate crimes. This is something we're looking at very carefully because it's this serious.
because it's not much of a step from jokes to, you know, acts. Don't you think? 12 minutes before the hour, let's run over and see who's on the phone. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello?
Can you hear me, Bob?
I hear you.
Can you hear me?
I hear you.
This is Richard. Richard in Eastern Tennessee.
Hey, Richard, how are you?
I'm doing okay. I have a question for you. When I'm changing the topic now. I got the sense that you're not too swift on Kamala Harris and wanted to know why.
Wait. Well, no. I don't have a beef with Kamala Harris.
Oh, I do.
Well, I mean, well, let's put it this way. I know what's being put out there, but I also recognize that there aren't any perfect candidates. If we sit around waiting for the perfect candidate, Richard, we'll be waiting for a very long time, like forever.
Yes, true. Well, she first came to my attention when I was living in California, and she attacked her boss with a vicious smear campaign and got his job, which was for DA of San Francisco. And the thing was that he was a good guy, her boss. And, you know, very liberal Democrat type. So that's where my attention got grabbed at the first place. I mean, you know, why the hell was she doing this to him? And then it just seems like she rose like a rocket through the party. I don't think she's finished one, job before she jumped to another one. So I just feel like I don't trust the person.
Well, she's the way you describe it, she's obviously ambitious.
Yes, very much so.
She has done a fairly impressive job cross-examining, for instance, Trump administration nominees, and has asked in some cases harder and more pointed questions than God knows every Republican and most of the Democrats.
I've been impressed with her performance. I have to say that.
There are people who, I've just seen it. There are people who absolutely despise her.
Really?
Yeah, and that number has probably grown since her campaign. Well, there's no campaign, but since she has been spoken of approvingly by former members of the Hillary Clinton campaign. So she is now tainted with having had her name said in the same breath as Hillary Clinton, which of course Hillary Clinton is the devil, and that makes Kamala Harris at least a minor demon. I mean, I laugh. It's a little facetious. But there really is a whole lot of purity testing going on out there right now.
Right. Yeah, I noticed.
And frankly, I don't know. I mean, I read some of the stuff that is put forward about her that's supposed to be absolutely damning, and I'm not sure if it's as damning as it's made out to be. I can't offer you specifics right now. But, you know, and didn't she go from DA of San Francisco to Attorney General of California?
Yes, she did. She did. I don't know if it was directly, if there was another job in between, but she went from DA in San Francisco to the state level. Let me put it that way.
I think she made it to Attorney General, unless I'm mistaken.
Yes, she did. She did, Bob.
And then as Attorney General, she did things that have not passed purity muster.
And so the fact that she's been mentioned as a potential candidate in 2020 has lit up a certain segment of the so-called left. And you know what I say every time I say the so-called left. Ah, what left?
What left, yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of left, you know, here I am in the little town of Athens, Tennessee, and I've been engaged with the left here. And it's been very interesting for me as a New Yorker and a Californian. You know, I grew up in New York City, and so to be here is quite an interesting thing. I mean, this is such a Republican place. The Democrats don't exist except for the county clerk, who is a Democrat, keeps getting reelected, and she's the only one.
And I'm sure that if you scratch more than skin deep, you'll find that she believes everything a Republican needs to be believe.
No, she doesn't. I mean, I've talked with the woman.
Is she all right to choose? And
no, she's one of us. And there's an organization called Indivisible. Have you ever heard of them?
Oh, yes, quite.
Yeah, I'm not too familiar, but there is a branch here in McMinn County. And I've been to two of their events. And they've been kind of interesting because there's a candidate running for Congress here in my district against a man who's, you know, very much a Tea Party type, who's run unopposed. I mean, United States Congress, of course. And she's a young doctor. I say young, meaning in her 30s, I think. Her name is Dr. Mitchell, and I forgot her first name. And she's saying all the right things.
Well,
so,
the South didn't turn around overnight. It only feels that way, but if it's ever going to come back to its senses, that's not going to happen overnight either, Richard.
Right.
So, I'm glad you got one, and I'm glad that apparently she has the courage to actually be a Democrat, you know, stand up for a woman's right to choose, that kind of thing.
Yeah, she's running as a Democrat. And it's interesting, her card, you know, like business card for Congress, does not say Democrat on it anywhere at all. Yet she is running as a Democrat.
Well, you'll find that not necessarily all over the South, but certainly all over the South, but other places as well. It started with the Republicans. Back when Republicans were in a minority, they would run and not put Republican on any of their signage.
Oh, really?
And now the same thing applies to Democrats, because the conventional wisdom is that the electorate hates party politics. I mean, I saw it all over West Virginia in the 2016 election. You had people who you knew were running as Democrats, and they wouldn't put Democrat on their signs because it was the kiss of death.
Interesting. Now here I have a little tiny poster for a guy named Carl Dean who's running. He came and spoke to the Democrats meeting here that just happened a week ago, and he's running as a Democrat. Carl Dean. He's running for governor of Tennessee. And he's been the mayor of Nashville, and as you said, it doesn't say Democrat here at all.
And that'll be the same for anybody else who runs.
Yeah.
Because, remember, you're in the South. So that means if you're a Democrat, you put, like, fetus blood on your Wheaties.
Is it that bad?
Yes, it's that bad.
Boy.
I mean, last night I had the clip of the religious maniac who's,
Hurricane Harvey hit Houston because of all the precious little fetuses that we done abortulated. Because God loves fetuses, but he'll kill innocent people because people who didn't kill fetuses need to die for fetuses being killed.
Where'd you hear this?
Oh, it was last night. I ran the clip.
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah, we really don't have enough time. Otherwise, I'd play it for you now. But
yeah, I can't listen to the whole program because my computer battery runs out.
Ah. And you can't just keep it plugged in?
Not this one. No, it's real awkward. I take the computer into my bedroom, the laptop. It's just too awkward to try to plug it in here, so I charge it up every day at night. This is not my only computer. I've been fortunate to have recycled desktop machines in the house, too, but this is a problem with each one of them.
Okay.
So I won't get it now because it's time to go.
Yeah, it is time to go, but it's awful good to hear from you, Richard.
Good to talk with you, Bob.
All right, take care and have a good night.
Great. Bye.
Bye. Our buddy Richard, formerly of the Bay Area, now far, far away from the Bay. It is time to get out of here. Thank you, everyone. Thank you for joining in this evening. Thank you for being part of the community. Thank you for sharing the precious, finite time of your life engaging in this little conversation. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you very kindly to Midweek Utility Pinch Hit chat room moderator Steve from Georgistan, all-around great guy. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, Coal River Mountain Watch on Facebook, and at Coal River MTN on Twitter. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Good night, y'all.